Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
We may not have an overall recession. We're having a rolling recession.
The economy overall looks pretty strong, at least when it comes to jobs.
The financial stories that shape our world.
Three major regional bank failures
sent shockwaves through the banking system.
We're all trying to figure out what to make of generative AI.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Welcome now, Dr. Paul Krugman.
Brian Moynihan of Bank of America.
Deborah Lehr of the Paulson Institute.
Glenn Hubbard of the Columbia Business School.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Up in the air on whether Elon Musk moves to Texas, on the future of Boeing, on when tech will see that AI payoff, and on when the Fed will get a move on. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, special contributor Larry Summers on U.S. jobs numbers.
I was surprised, not shocked, that the job numbers came in that way.
Chip War author Chris Miller of Tufts on governments funding the tech race.
All of the world's governments, from the U.S. to Japan to Europe to China, are pouring tens of billions of dollars into their own chip industries.
And Nobel economist Paul Krugman of CUNY on what the election could mean for U.S. trade policy.
Tariffs don't eliminate trade deficits unless they get so high as to basically make trade impossible.
Wall Street looked at a lot of questions this week, but did not get many answers, as Elon Musk threatened to take his marbles along with his Tesla and go home to Texas after a Delaware court said he couldn't take home that $55 billion pay package his board had promised him.
If shareholders, upon the board's recommendation, decide to move to Nevada, they have a right to do that. But it's not a Musk decision.
Boeing's crisis over the 737 MAX 9 aircraft is far from resolved. As the government limited future production, the company said it would take a day off to reflect on what happened, and its chief executive admitted it was at fault.
We caused the problem, and we understand that. And we instituted additional quality controls and inspections at Boeing and at our supplier.
Big tech announced earnings this week, and although they were strong, they didn't entirely measure up to what some had hoped, leaving open the question of just when those promised AI profits are likely to hit the bottom line.
The earnings that came out last night were excellent earnings by any measure. They just maybe didn't meet the loftiest of lofty expectations.
And the Fed surprised absolutely no one by not moving at all or giving much real sense of when it will.
I don't think it's likely that the committee will reach a level of confidence by the time of the March meeting to identify March as the time to do that. But that's to be seen.
Then on Friday, U.S. jobs numbers underscored why the Fed may be reluctant to cut rates in the near future, as 350,000 new jobs were almost double what people had expected, and the unemployment rate stayed at a very low 3.7%. After an up-and-down week, the equity markets were off to the races on the jobs news, with the S&P 500 ending up just under 1.4% up for the week, a new record, and that beats the median number of our Bloomberg Alves for the end of the year, while the NASDAQ added over 1%. And the yield in the 10-year jumped 15 basis points on Friday alone, though for the week it was actually down 12 basis points to end just over 4%. To take us through the week in the markets, welcome back now Sunal Desai. She's Franklin Templeton's fixed income CIO, and Peter Kraus, founder, chair, and CEO of Aperture Investors. So Sunal, why don't you give us your take on what we saw in the markets this week up to the close on Friday?
Well, you know, the market has been so positioned for, and it's not entirely clear on the back of what, but positioned for massive early Fed rate cuts. That wasn't going to happen. And in many ways, what Powell said during his press conference, he left the door open for potentially cutting. I don't think he should, and I don't think they will. But the immediate reaction to Powell's statement was still a bit of a rally before bond markets started selling off eventually. Overall, I think, unfortunately, it still is the case that in December, the Fed reinserted itself into the story of the market, and we continue to see an easing of financial conditions, which certainly makes the Fed's job somewhat harder in terms of deciding when to cut. And they want to cut. That's clear. That's clear.
So, Peter, explain one thing. We had a sort of unusual week where we had rates up in the form of the yield and equities up at the same time. How do you explain those two things?
Well, first of all, you made an interesting point that rates are up today, but not actually up relative to the week. Secondly, normally when rates have that big a move, the markets do actually go down. That's been the recent consensus move. But as you saw today, there are two really big stocks, Amazon and Meta, that were up dramatically during the day. And if you actually adjust for that, I'm not sure the market was up much at all. And the Russell, of course, was down 40 basis points. So I actually think the markets are reacting somewhat negatively to Powell taking his foot off the gas of cutting rates. But I would agree with Sunal, and I've said for a while, I don't think the Fed is going to cut rates early. I think they're going to wait for inflation to actually break. I think inflation has done better, but it is still elevated, and you see job growth and you see wage growth.
So Sunal, I think you two are agreeing mm-hmm. that there are going to be cuts. The question is how big and how soon. What do you expect for this rest of the year?
You know, I haven't changed my views now for quite a while, and I was in the 50 basis point camp in December when Powell spoke. It became pretty clear that the Fed would like to do 75. I think maybe they'll do 75, but it's going to be in the second half of the year. I'm not changing any of that, really, because it's not that I expect inflation to run away or pick up strongly. I just don't think it's going to come down convincingly enough to allow for early rate cuts. And definitely the political calendar complicates this, but abstracting from that, I think it's second half and 75 basis points.
This is what I don't quite understand, Peter. When you've got this kind of growth, which is very robust, and this kind of employment, what we're seeing right now, why is there a need to cut rates? I mean, why do we need to stimulate the economy through monetary policy right now?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I do think that we're seeing a very strong and resilient economy up and down the income spectrum. And although there are some delinquencies that are rising in the consumer world, we still have people well employed with jobs that are paying even more than they paid last year. So the Fed is looking at inflation, and inflation has come down from 8% or 7% down to 4, down to 3, but is it really going to fall much faster? And so I think the Fed is going to be very careful about taking short rates down. And I think it's quite possible that longer rates go up from here, not down from here.
So given what you just said, Peter, why don't people feel better about it? Because everything we see and all the polls taken, people don't feel that great about the economy, and yet you describe an economy that's pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's a question that many people have asked, and I myself am a bit confused about it. But I think the answer really falls in how inflation affects people's spending capability. So yes, wages are up, But remember, wages are up following a very high period of inflation, which changed the ability for consumers to actually spend money. It really changed their discretionary spending patterns, and it changed what they had left over to actually use for something else. So if you have to spend more money on food, and you have to spend more money on gas, and you have to spend money on the things that you have to spend money on, then you have a lot less for everything else, and people feel pinched. And that's not going to change until you get enough wage growth to actually overcome the effect of that inflation on your actual living expenses. Remember, we don't have deflation. Prices aren't coming down. They're just not going up faster. So it's going to take some time, and people are not going to feel great about it for a while.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. Sunal Desai of Franklin Templeton and Peter Krause of Aperture Investors have stayed with us. We've talked on this program, Peter, in the past about the growth of private credit and private equity. It seems sometimes like the trees are growing to the sky. I know you've just gotten back from Miami talking to an MFA conference about portfolio allocation. Is there a point at which maybe we start not rushing forward in private quite so fast?
Yeah, I think we are at that point. I think that in the last 15 years, we've had declining interest rates, benign credit environments, and very low yields. And the place where you could get more yield was in the private space, particularly in private credit. And the place where you got more return in equity was in private equity. And a lot of that was in growth investing, venture capital. I think at this point, we have to be more cautious about those spaces. And the liquidity coming out of those areas that you invested in has slowed down dramatically. We know that there's a lot less M&A. We know there's a lot less IPOs in the private equity space. There are continuation funds being talked about in credit, so maybe your credit comes back slower than you thought. So I do think, we said this in the earlier session, is that yields in the liquid space have grown dramatically. And so if you're thinking about where you're going to allocate your next dollar, would it really be in that private space, or would it make more sense to actually be opportunistic in the liquid space and find a place to actually get reasonable yields with liquidity in that area?
So now weigh in here from the fixed income side. How does this play out in fixed income? Private credit, syndicated loans, liquid credit, how does it play out?
So basically, it is exactly true. For the last 15 years, illiquidity was almost sought after because liquid assets yielded so little. What I would say is today, with liquid assets, I look at high yield, for example, and even with the current yield compression, you are getting all-in returns of something like 7.5%. If you look at bank loans or floating rate, you know, which is a little bit even, you know, it's very short duration, it's looking good at around 9% or so. I think that private markets are going to need to give a significant premium for the illiquidity in a period when liquidity starts compressing as central banks start ending their periods of QE and so on. So that's one element. But against this background, there are many institutional investors who quite like having assets which are not marked to market because you don't see the volatility constantly, right? So I think there's a bit of a trade-off there. Nonetheless, with liquid fixed income markets yielding as well as they currently are, I'm very optimistic about fixed income over the next few years relative to last decade.
I think there's some risk in not marking to market assets at the end of the day.
Oh, yeah.
I fully get that I don't want to see my assets go up and down. I fully get that it's nice to smooth them. But at the end of the day, if you actually don't know what the values are, that's not exactly a good place to be. And I also think that we've had very few periods in the last 15 years. We've had extended period of time when asset values are hard to determine. We've had short reductions and very rapid increases. But if you go for 2 years where your assets are kind of difficult to value, that's a tough place for any fiduciary to be.
Yeah, not knowing the value may be part of the reason why they're not distributing the cash back, right?
And because they don't have the cash.
Exactly. Right. And when they sold them, it might not be as much as they thought. Okay, many thanks now to Peter Krause of Aperture Investors and Sunal Desai of Franklin Templeton. Coming up, the race for governments to subsidize chip production around the world. We talk with Chris Miller of Tufts University, author of Chip Wars. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
What a reversal today, when Japanese manufacturers have been so brilliantly successful at selling to, and in many cases even taking over, American markets, that practically every politician in the U.S. is scrambling to touch our nerves of xenophobia and to find a way of restricting and weakening these seemingly omnipotent foreign devils. Or look at the all-too-typical furor, this time involving Japanese chip producers, who were accused this week of the awful crime of selling their semiconductors outside the U.S. at steep discounts.
That was Louis Rukeyser on Wall Street Week back in 1986, when the issue was computer chips coming from Japan. Today, it's Chinese chips that has Washington concerned, something laid out by Chris Miller of Tufts University in his book, Chip War. We asked him for an update, given the billions of dollars in U.S. subsidies about to be announced under the Chips and Science Act.
The boom in investment in artificial intelligence has impacted the chip industry too. And today there's actually a shortage of the types of chips that are used to train AI systems. Even the biggest companies in the world, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, can't get enough of these specialized AI chips. And in part because of this, all of the world's governments, from the US to Japan to Europe to China, are pouring tens of billions of dollars into their own chip industries, trying to make sure they've got that competitive ability to stay up with regard to these chip-making capabilities that are needed for AI chips.
At the same time, there have been various actions taken by the U.S. government and others to restrict China's access to some of the machinery, if I can put it that way, the technology to develop these chips. How effective is that, do we know?
Well, I think the honest answer is that it's still pretty early in the process. The restrictions went into place in late 2022, and the goal of the restrictions was not really to stop China in its tracks, but rather to slow its progress over time. And so China's continuing to make progress. SMIC, the leading Chinese chip maker, is moving forward in its technological capabilities. But I think it's already likely the case that it's moving forward at a slower rate than it would have had these controls not been in place. And you know, the key is not really where is China, but it's where is China relative to the most advanced capabilities in Taiwan or in the United States or in South Korea. And there you see that China is making some progress closing the gap, but a really sizable gap remains.
A lot of these chips actually get put into other products that get imported. Do we know where the chips are coming from?
Well, I think that's part of the challenge. You're right to say that the U.S. and Europe and Japan are the same. We don't actually import many chips from China directly. Most of the Chinese chips in our systems are actually first sent to Vietnam, then to the Philippines, then to Malaysia. And some companies don't always know the origins of every single component inside of their system. And that's why a traditional anti-dumping tariff might be less relevant in this case.
It's not just the United States and China, but also I've read now about Japan actually investing in at least the precursors to some of the chip manufacturing. What is the role of Japan potentially in subsidizing some of the more advanced chips?
Well, today Japan doesn't produce any of the most advanced chips domestically, but it plays a major role in producing the machines and also the chemicals that are needed in cutting-edge chip making. And there's some really unique expertise among a handful of Japanese firms, especially in the chemicals sphere, where Japan has very high levels of market share and limited competition because they've been investing in this sphere for now several decades. And that's where the Japanese government is focusing a lot of its efforts and retaining its advantages that it has over other countries in these chemicals.
That was Chris Miller of Tufts.
Elections have consequences, including for business and the economy. When President Trump was elected in 2016, markets reacted violently and turned out to be violently wrong.
But you'll remember a lot of us kind of got this wrong on election night when it looked like Trump was going to win. Initially, the market crashed. Then people said, wait a minute, the market soared up again, and it kind of took off from there.
And right now, it looks like we may get a second look at Mr. Trump's approach to the economy as he appears to be headed to renomination as the Republican candidate. And if nominated, would be a serious contender to replace President Biden. Some say that the Biden record on economics stacks up favorably to former President Trump's.
For the first time in history, we have two candidates that have been president, so you have a track record of what to expect. In the case of President Biden, you had so far 3 years of steadiness, good growth, markets at an all-time high. I think it's underappreciated what has gone on with the economy.
Others see President Biden's policies insufficiently pro-growth.
People are frustrated, and it's the economic policies of the Biden administration that has brought us here. It's the president's policies of paying people not to work after the pandemic, massive multi-trillion dollar spending bills that drove inflation. And the end result is if you speak to people here in Wisconsin, regular folks on the street, they're getting clobbered by Bidenomics, and they want to see Washington change course.
And then you have experts like Glenn Hubbard who worry that there isn't a big enough difference between the two.
What strikes me in looking at least at President Biden and former President Trump's policies is less how different they are than how similar they are. So in terms of protectionism, in terms of a fondness for industrial policy, in terms of intervention in financial markets, the two men are more similar than they are different.
But whoever gets the presidential nod this year, they're going to be faced with some big issues of the federal deficit and debt.
The problem is that's led us to years and years of borrowing too much. We now have a debt that's about to be at record levels.
I think we're in a terrible place, David, because unfortunately, once you get to legislating, there's a lot of talk. But the talk is always divided politically between the Republicans who refuse to raise taxes and the Democrats who won't deal with entitlements. I do think when we eventually get to doing this, about 60% or something of the increase in the debt from 2000 to 2022 was because of the tax cuts.
For his thoughts on what difference the election outcome could make for the economy, we welcome now Dr. Paul Krugman, Nobel laureate in economics and distinguished professor at the City University of New York Graduate Center. So, Dr. Krugman, thank you so much for being back with us. Before we talk about what differences there may be in the leading candidates right now in November, give us your sense of the economy overall and what we're likely to need over the next 4 years. Then we can talk about who might be most likely to provide it.
Okay, so we are in an extraordinarily good immediate position. I've been arguing with people who say, this is a Goldilocks economy, and that's wrong. Goldilocks found a porridge that was neither too hot nor too cold. We've got an economy that's hot where you want it to be hot, like in GDP growth, and cold where you want it to be cold on inflation. So this is, right now is in a lot of ways the best short run economy we've had since the 1990s. So what we need for the next 4 years is to be thinking about the long run.
Do we need to at least start to think about the deficit and the debt that's accumulating? Because right now, as you look at Donald Trump and Joe Biden, the two leading candidates, neither one seems to be willing to address that. By the way, this week, Congress did do something on taxation, which was actually it was negative in terms of deficit. So do we need to address that question? And if so, when?
I'm not a complete deficits never matter guy. But I'm not, it still doesn't look like a first rank issue, despite the, you know, the enormous numbers, but, you know, everything about America is enormous. Particularly there's a lot of the sustainability of debt depends a lot on comparison between interest rates and the economy's growth rate. And right now what we have is interest rates seem to be coming down. Growth seems to, you know, productivity growth is looking really good. There are high hopes for AI, all of which means that despite the huge size of those raw debt numbers, I actually don't think that there's any urgency.
History, we're told, does not repeat itself, but it does rhyme sometimes. Is there a rhyme with 1993? Because if you go back to 1993, you talk to Bob Rubin about what happened with President Clinton, it's thought that we got a lot of growth out of the 90s in part because we both increased some taxes and cut some spending. Is there a similar opportunity here for pro-growth policies?
I'm a great admirer of Bob Rubin, but I don't believe that story for a minute. It's just not what looks like actually happened in the 90s. What actually happened in the 90s was that businesses finally figured out what to do with these computer things. And we got a decade of good productivity growth because we finally figured out how to make productive use of IT. And I actually don't think that Clinton administration policies made much difference one way or the other. So I just don't buy that. It's just, and we may be approaching another moment like that. Again, you know, recent productivity numbers are really quite good. AI, maybe it's either going to destroy us or all or possibly give us another decade of good productivity growth. So no, I just don't, that whole responsible fiscal policy was responsible for the roaring 90s. It's a lovely narrative. I don't think there's anything to support it.
President Trump, former President Trump, has said that he would favor a 10% across the board, not just China, across the board tariff on imports. And actually, Mr. Lighthizer, his advisor section, maybe we increase that to eliminate trade deficit. What would that do to the growth of the American economy?
Okay. Now, a dirty little secret of international trade economics is that moderate tariff rates do not, at least according to our models, and as far as we can tell in practice, don't have huge growth effects. They distort consumption and production choices. They do some damage, but to get really big numbers, you have to get well beyond 10%. So if the goal is to eliminate the trade deficit, Lighthizer was going to have a surprise because tariffs don't eliminate trade deficits unless they get so high as to basically make trade impossible. So we would be talking about much, much higher tariff rates potentially. What's worries me is not, I mean, I think there are a lot of really negative consequences if the U.S. does a 10% tariff, but they're sort of geopolitical more than anything else. They would mean that the United States is basically saying, well, we're opting out of our role as a leader of the global economy. It would have a lot of bad effects. In terms of the economic impact, I mean, I'm hearing a talk about, well, let's have 60% tariffs on imports from China. And, roughly speaking, the adverse effects of a tariff are proportional to something like the square of the tariff rate. So a 60% tariff is, 30, 36% times as bad as a 10% tariff. So if we start to get into those kinds of tariffs, yeah, then we are actually talking about significant negative impacts.
Dr. Krugman, thank you so very much for being on Wall Street Week. Really appreciate it. That is Nobel laureate Paul Krugman. Coming up, we wrap up the week with special contributor Larry Summers of Harvard.
I'm much less prepared to declare that it's all over than I think Paul is.
That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA, SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. We are joined once again this week by our very special contributor, Larry Summers of Harvard. Larry, thanks so much for being with us. We have to start with those wow, as some people are calling them, jobs numbers that came out, way above expectation. What did you make of them?
Look, the economy's been surprising on the upside for a while, so I was surprised, not shocked, that the job numbers came in that way. It was a pretty broadly strong report. Household survey, business survey, wage numbers, especially given that the weather was pretty bad in January in many parts of the country, which probably held the numbers down below what would have been their normal level. And what that suggests is that despite the interest rate hikes of the Fed, there's a lot of strength in the economy. My instinct is that that is telling you, as I've been saying for some time on your show, David, that some combination of a higher neutral rate is the world we're living in, and possibly, quite possibly, spending has become less interest sensitive over time because there's less housing in the economy relative to GDP because durable goods are less durable and so long-lived than they used to be, because there's more flow of income to the rest of the economy from larger government debts, and that makes interest rates operate in the other direction. So I think what we've learned is that what we might have thought would be substantially restrictive monetary policy based on the magnitude of the interest rate hikes really wasn't.
Well, and we heard from the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, this week saying she's not sure that the interest rates, the long-term interest rates, will come back down. They may remain elevated in part because of how robust the economy is. We also heard the Fed Chair, Jay Powell, say his concern isn't so much about reacceleration of inflation, but it just won't come all the way down. On the other hand, despite the wage increases, productivity is at high levels right now. I just checked. I think it's like 3.2% right now. Might that save us?
The answer is yes, yes, and yes. I welcome Secretary Yellen's recognition that given prospective budget deficits, given prospective increases in investment demand, we really don't know where neutral interest rates are going to be. I'll be interested in seeing what's in the administration forecast when it comes out. I think one would want to be guessing that Treasury bill rates will be averaging well above 3% through the rest of this decade.
Larry, we talked with your economist colleague, Paul Krugman, this week about inflation and what we should have expected. And he admitted that he actually underestimated the issue of inflation. He thought it would not be as big and last as long. And he sort of called you up by name, saying he thought you'd stayed too long on the old models, that you hadn't appreciated that this was really a once-in-a-lifetime experience with the pandemic and the shutdown of the supply. What do you have to say about that? Do you, in retrospect, did you overpredict the need for unemployment to get inflation down?
Look, I think we're having a softer landing than I would have expected so far. We'll see how inflation settles out, but we are having that. I think Paul tends to attribute it to a whole set of stuff on the supply side. I see the largest fiscal stimulus by far since World War II. I see nominal GDP growth rising in double digits. I see an economy that gives evidence of booming and gave evidence of booming before the supply stuff was fixed. And so I think demand is a pretty big part of the story. But yes, the outcome has been more benign than those of us who drew the implications from standard models predicted. I think if you look back, we recognize that there was enormous uncertainty. But yes, things did come back in a way that was more favorable than standard models would have expected, though I'm much less prepared to declare that it's all over. We have not yet landed this plane. No one, to my knowledge, thinks the kind of job growth we've seen over this month or over the last quarter is medium-term sustainable. And that means, and no one thinks we're all the way back to 2% inflation on a durable basis. And so that means that there are still issues around the landing.
What's your take on what really happened in the 1990s and the relationship between that 93 Act and the tax increases and spending cuts on the one hand and growth on the other?
Look, there's no question that the economy hit good fortune from technology in the 1990s, and that's an important part of the story. But you know, when you bring down capital costs, that's when people tend to take a longer view. That's when there's more investment in technology. That produces growth. And I think what those of us who were in the Clinton administration always felt was that by cutting interest rates, you could turn a vicious cycle of high capital costs and low investment into a virtuous circle of lower capital costs, more investment, more growth, lower deficits, and the cycle goes round again. And I think you can never replay history, but gosh, I think if we had failed to act strongly with respect to the deficit in 1993, I don't think we would have seen the kind of economic miracle that happened in the 1990s. At the same time, look, I think on shows like this, people in markets do have a tendency to put all the emphasis on the short-run tools of monetary and fiscal policies, and it's a mistake to recognize structure and technology as driving forces of what happens in the economy. And I think in that area, the Clinton administration was fortunate in just what was happening in the private sector, but also whether it was telecommunications, whether it was the approach that was taken to the internet, acted wisely in creating an environment that made it very attractive for the private sector to invest. And in all honesty, I think there are important lessons from that moderate, progressive approach for policy going forward.
Larry, thank you so very much. That's Larry Summers, our very special contributor here on Wall Street Week. He's from Harvard. Finally, one more thought. Author Orrin Woodward says he who controls the fool's gold controls the fool. All of us are looking for some pot of gold at the end of our rainbow, whether it's in tangible wealth or in something a bit less tangible. So we pay a lot of attention to those who do particularly well for themselves, like, for example, Elon Musk, becoming the richest man in the world through his Tesla electric vehicles and SpaceX satellite launches.
Elon Musk is seeing his own net worth jump by more than anyone so far this year. He and the world's 500 richest people have gained more than $850 billion in wealth.
Or the late Dr. Paul Farmer realizing a lifelong dream to change the world.
People shouldn't die of a readily treatable disease because they're poor.
But sometimes, and maybe too often, what at first appears to be a truly great deal ends up too good to be true. That's certainly what Bernie Madoff's investors learned the hard way.
This is the real tragedy. This is where the human tragedy comes in. Those people organized their lives around the fact that they had real profits when in fact there were never any assets at all beyond that which they put in.
As did investors in Enron. Developing a new technology to diagnose what ails us through a single drop of blood seemed a godsend to patients and investors alike, until it turned out that Elizabeth Holmes' Theranos was all an elaborate fraud.
For government prosecutors, this was put plainly as a case about fraud. They said it was a story about a Silicon Valley founder and executive who had lied and cheated in order to raise money from investors, and at the same time deceived customers and doctors about the capabilities of Theranos' technology.
Even Elon Musk may in the end find out that his quest for X, that's formerly known as Twitter, leaves him with more fool's gold than real gold.
I'm wondering how much Elon Musk is regretting this impulsive decision to buy Twitter.
This week, we got a particularly powerful reminder of the dangers in letting our ambition or our greed get the better of us. When news came out of Minnesota about a ruby slippers caper, it appears that Mr. Terry Martin of Grand Rapids, Minnesota, that's the hometown of Judy Garland, bought into a plan to steal an original pair of the ruby slippers worn by Ms. Garland when she played Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. The 72-year-old Mr. Martin had past experience with stealing jewels, having served prison time for burglary. But unfortunately, that past experience did not include having actually seen The Wizard of Oz. And so, when he was approached by what his lawyer called an old mob associate, he willingly believed that they were called ruby slippers because they were just that, covered with real rubies. Why else would they be insured for $1 million? So you can imagine his surprise when his old mob associate took one look at the shoes and told him those supposed rubies were really only colored glass. Disappointed, Martin walked away, leaving them with his partner in crime. Eventually, the slippers made it back to the museum after the insurance company offered a $200,000 reward. And Mr. Martin, who is in hospice care and not expected to live long, got off with time served and 1 year of supervised release. So in the end, like Dorothy, Terry Martin of Grand Rapids, Minnesota, can return home after all.
There's no place like home.
That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.